This is an audio archive edition of WINA's Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot, made available online by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, cvillepodcast.com. On the September 5th edition of the show, Coy's guest is Jeffrey Nunberg, a linguist at the University of California at Berkeley and the author of a new book, Talking Right, about how conservative groups have framed the terms of debate in American politics.
You start your book by writing, and I'll just read here, Democratic pollster Stanley Greenberg says that the Republicans had, quote, a narrative that motivated their voters. Senator Barack Obama is calling for a, quote, unquote, new narrative for the Democrats. Thomas Frank, UVA graduate, the author of What's the Matter with Kansas, says conservatives have captured the narrative of social class. And in a New Republic piece, Robert Wright, former of labor, the former guy in the Clinton administration, Secretary of Labor, he argued that Republicans have mastered the art of political narrative and in so doing have exiled Democrats from politics itself. What is all of this about a narrative? Why is it important for us?
It's a kind of bogus word, and I have some qualms about using it, but it is a good word for what's going on. I guess I agree to a large extent with Tom Frank, who writes about the way in which the divisions of class and the economic divisions that really matter most in American life have been deflected into kind of pseudo-populism by the right, by the Republicans, that substitutes these divisions, these bogus social divisions, the division into red and blue states and so on. David Brooks, the New York Times columnist, writes about the way he says, well, America isn't really like a layer cake. It's more like a high school cafeteria with each group and clique at its own table and so forth. And that's the vision of American life that the right has been trying to put together and has put together very successfully to the point where the basic economic divisions, the divisions that you could talk about Clinton's people who work hard and play by the rules and between them and the people who benefited from the Bush tax cuts, those divisions tend to be lost sight of, and instead we talk all the time about these cultural divisions, which, as I say, are largely bogus and have very little to do with politics, in fact.
Jeffrey Nunberg is a linguist at the University of California at Berkeley. He's our guest this hour, and we invite you to join the conversation at 977-1070. You know, I thought it was so interesting when you talk about the word liberal. I thought it was so fascinating how just, not quite a generation ago, it had a completely different power, a different presence on the political scene. And you write that the trashing of the liberal label is one of the most significant changes in the language of American politics in recent times.
Yeah, no, it is as recently as the mid-60s, people could say that no one who didn't take liberalism seriously or didn't who counted himself as an absolute opponent of liberalism could hope to have power in the political scene. By the but within 20 years, liberals become the L word. It's a word that people won't even speak. And nowadays, you won't find many liberals who will actually own up to the label. They'll say, "Oh well, I don't believe in labels," or they'll say, "Well, I'm a progressive," hoping that other word will do the job for them. And I think that's become the single most the telling sign of the way American politics and the American political language has changed.
Exactly how did conservatives do this? I mean, is it the kind of thing that if you just keep repeating over and over again, this is bad, this is bad, this is bad, that it just starts to sink in the same way a political campaign
is? Let me say, as I mentioned before, I think liberals had a lot of responsibility for this. Vietnam was part of the story. The perceived failure of Great Society programs, programs like busing, which working class whites saw not without reason as impositions by upper middle class liberals who didn't really have a stake in public education. All of that helped to erode liberalism. But this really began with a campaign that was undertaken in the 1970s and that was highly coordinated and still is to brand liberals not simply as people who held certain beliefs about politics, who believed that Social Security should be retained in its present form, who believed in an expanded government role in health care and so forth, beliefs that Americans across the board hold, but in particular those people who the Eastern and West Coast elite liberals and so on, who had these self-indulgent lifestyles and so forth. And one of the striking things, if you look in the press, nowadays, for the phrase working class liberal, it doesn't exist. you can hold all those beliefs that define the Democratic Party and traditional liberalism, but if you don't have money to buy the granite countertops and the lattes that go with this stereotype, you don't count as a liberal.
Let's talk about that whole idea, the idea of branding, using words to brand ideas, but also using these real brands from the marketplace, whether it's a Volvo or a cafe latte at Starbucks, to brand people.
Right. This all happened, it's interesting to note, at a time when that kind of consumerist language was becoming, was replacing the old social categories of American speech. You know, when I was growing up, to be a preppy, you had to spend 4 years at Choate or Andover, one of those schools. Nowadays, it's merely a question of spending a couple hours in Abercrombie and Fitch in the afternoon, and these words like yuppie, and other lifestyle terms become part of the language. So it seems very natural for Republicans to go and begin to brand liberals according to the products they consume. They drive Volvos, the safe car from socialist Sweden that has, as I say, a fortuitous gynecological resonance in its name. That's, I think, why Saabs weren't picked for that. They drink these light and soft products like latte and Chardonnay and so forth, and Brie. And that became the way of characterizing these people. In fact, it isn't even true at the level of consumer habits. It turns out that the majority of Brie buyers in America are actually Republicans, which isn't surprising. It's an upscale product. It's not something you see in the corner stores in inner-city neighborhoods. But even so, it stands in for this stereotype that the right has created of liberals. It's soft, it's pale, it's runny, it's French. What better thing to stand in for the liberal stereotype?
Jeffrey Nunberg is our guest, a linguist at the University of California, Berkeley. His new book is Talking Right. I guess one of the great lessons then over the last few decades is that politicians can use and manipulate stereotypes to great advantage.
Well, that's not a lesson we had to wait till the last few decades to learn. It's something that's always gone on. I think in the last, what's happened in the last few years, a couple of things. First of all, the Republicans have done this with much more deftness than the Democrats have. And that's been a part, and certainly not the main part or the most important part of their success electorally. And in the second place, everybody's gotten a lot more smooth at it. It has to do with the modern media. In the same way that, when you look at just product advertisements from the early days of television, you see how crude they are and how much more sophisticated advertisers have gotten. Well, it's the same thing with the manipulation of political language. It's a lot subtler now than it was 50 or 100 years ago.
We're talking with Jeff Nunberg of the University of California, Berkeley. His new book is Talking Right. We're going to take a very quick break. You're listening to Charlottesville right now. And you'll get California, Berkeley. He joins us on the long line from his office in San Francisco. He is the author of a new book, Talking Right: How Conservatives Turned Liberalism into a Tax-Raising, Latte-Drinking, Sushi-Eating, Volvo-Driving, New York Times-Reading, Body-Piercing, Hollywood-Loving, Left-Wing Freak Show. Can we talk a little bit about the whole idea of elite? You write in your book how this is not a new strategy by any political party to play to voters' ideas of elite. But there's sort of a new strategy now, and we live in a country where the elite are no longer seen as the wealthiest and most influential. They're seen as celebrities, academics, journalists.
Right. The original populism was an expression of the anger and resentment of ordinary Americans at the people who control the money interests, as they used to call it, the financiers, the bankers, the industrialists, who kept wheat prices low for farmers and so on and so forth. And that is what the elite originally meant, and meant until about 25 or 30 years ago in America. Still, the word elite was originally associated with bankers, corporate types, financiers, and so forth. The way it's still used in Britain, might I add, even by papers like Rupert Murdoch's Times, not simply by the papers on the left. If you look in papers now, or listen to broadcast, you see that elite is overwhelmingly used to describe people in Hollywood, academics, journalists, and so forth. George Bush, for example, is far less likely to be described as a member of an elite than the reporters who are covering him. People will talk, for instance, about ordinary Americans who shop at Walmart and the elite who take after Walmart, but the people who own Walmart somehow don't figure in that equation. So elite has really shifted in its meaning, and it's a signal of the way this populism has been turned from economic divisions to social and cultural divisions.
And it's almost like the real, what I would classify as the real elite, it's almost like they've disappeared. They've sort of melted
they're just
into
not
the background
anymore. People talk about the government versus the people. That's a favorite way for the right to put the story, without any mention of the corporations and others whom government has traditionally had an interest in at least restraining from the worst rapacity and the worst acts.
You write in your book, let's talk about the media a little bit. You write in the book that the mainstream media have been the right's most powerful ally in establishing its control of political language, not that they get any gratitude.
Right.
I've been raised to believe that the media were all liberal and there was this liberal conspiracy among journalists to go after conservatives.
Well, and one reason you're liable to believe that, and we're all liable to believe that, is when we look at those media, they report the story about how liberal the media are far more than they report by a factor of about 20 to 1, more than they report how the media have a conservative bias. So they themselves are doing the lion's share of work in persuading America that they have a liberal bias, which when you think about it, is a little paradoxical. If they were really that liberal, would they be pushing the story of liberal bias so hard? But I think if you just look at the language of the media, it becomes evident that whatever the personal views of reporters, and I don't think reporters are secretly conservative or right-wing or someone, just that they go along to get along. If you look at their language, they talk about conservative values, and this is things like the New York Times, the Washington Post, not the conservative press. They talk about conservative values three or four times as much as they talk about liberal values. They talk about the liberal elite far more often than they talk about the conservative elite. Or just on individual stories, if you look at the way they covered Social Security, as soon as the administration said, you know, we don't want to think of this as private accounts, let's call them personal accounts, the incidence of that phrase, personal accounts, shot up in newspapers all over America, left, right, and center. So I think one way or another, the press, not out of a conspiracy, but simply out of an effort to go along and use the language everybody else is using, or, and in particular that they're getting from the administration, has in fact played a very important part in disseminating the language of the right.
Jeffrey Nunberg is a linguist at the University of California at Berkeley. If you have a question or a comment, we invite you to join the conversation at 977-1070. You mentioned the word values, and one of the memorable line from the book was, the biggest mistake the Democrats have made is to take values on its face. Can you flesh that out for us?
Well, sure. If you think of values as in terms of its dictionary definition, moral principles or something like that, it's a pretty empty word. I mean, Republicans talk about values, Democrats talk about values. Everybody says they've got principles. That's what politicians are supposed to do. And Democrats have been trying to reclaim the word since really the mid-80s. And up till recently, the Kerry Edwards campaign baptizes itself a celebration of American values and keeps trying to take the V word back. But values, as the right uses is the term, isn't simply a stand-in for moral principles. It stands in for this particular set of stories that illustrate this narrative I've been talking about, this bogus populist narrative. It's the story about the judge, the lenient judge in Vermont, the Ten Commandments monument, the kids in Texas who aren't allowed to wear red and green to school at Christmas time, the woman in the UK who wants to marry a dolphin, which is what's going to happen if you allow gay marriage. All of these stories, silly, false, true, whatever, that illustrate this larger narrative about the way the good people of middle America have found their personal standards of morality, their patriotism, their religious faith mocked and betrayed by the supercilious elites on the coast. And this is the story that the right repeats over and over again, and that colors the right's positions on everything from taxes to Iraq in one way or another. This story keeps coming up, and that's the narrative that really anchors these words like values and gives them meaning. So you don't want to think just about the words, but about the stories that give them meaning is the point of that.
We use the word right and conservative almost at our peril to use it monolithically, as same as the left. Is there some kind of vast right-wing conspiracy?
No, I don't think there's really a right-wing conspiracy. I think in terms of communication, the right have been much more skillful at coordinating their communication. There's a lot more communication between the right-wing think tanks, the Republican Party, the right-wing broadcasters, than there is on the left. And that's just a fact. It's a long-term fact about Democrats and Republicans. And I think that shows up in the language itself. But one thing I did in the book, just as a sort of exercise, was to take the speeches from the first 2 days of the Republican convention in 1996 and run them, put them all in one file and run them through one of those summarizing programs that pulls out the key sentences and gives you a summary. What it came up with was a kind of distillation of every Republican speech you've heard over the last 20 years. It was the greatest Republican speech ever written. When I tried to do the same thing with the Democrats from their convention, it came up with word salad. It was just a mess. And the reason is that the Democrats weren't hitting on the same words and the same themes that gave the statistical regularities that the summarizer could work on. They were all over the place. They also spoke longer than the Republicans did. And that stands in for the styles of the two parties. But having said that, I don't think conspiracy is the right word for it. I think there's just a lot more coordination, and that the Democrats would be much better off if they could arrive at a level of coordination that at least approximated what Republicans on the right have been able to do.
It's like James Carville says, they produce a narrative, we produce a litany.
Right.
We're talking with Jeffrey Nunberg of the University of California, Berkeley. We're going to take a quick break for some local news and weather here at the bottom of the hour. You're listening to Charlottesville right now. Jeff Nunberg is a linguist at the University of California at Berkeley. He is chair of the usage panel at the American Heritage Dictionary and the author of The Way We Talk Now and Going Nuclear, and also his latest book, Talking Right, which we're discussing this hour right here on Charlottesville right now. Jeff, let me ask you this. It seems to be, you know, all this use or misuse of language by conservatives, ultimately, aren't all they saying is, capitalism works, America is the best country in the history of the world, freedom is worth fighting for, or are they saying something else?
Well, it's interesting the things you give there. What one of the things the right has done and done with some success is to take what I think most Americans would consider platitudes or matters of that are obvious and turn them into make as if they were controversial statements by way of suggesting that maybe liberals don't believe those things. So do liberals believe in freedom? Of course. Do they believe in America? I was just looking at some surveys done. 90% of Americans are either extremely proud or very proud to be Americans. Now, that's a little higher for Republicans than Democrats, but both numbers are just so vastly much higher than the same figures when you ask the British, the Swedes, the Germans, the French, the Italians the same question. That it's a wonder, for example, that patriotism should be an issue in America, given the high levels of patriotism among both Democrats and Republicans. Similarly, the belief in capitalism, people have different opinions as to how much control the government needs to exert to keep the private sector in line. Everybody thinks there has to be some control in matters of the environment, for instance, or health and safety and so on. Nobody believes in socialism. So these are all things that Americans are by and large on the same page about. And if I may, one of the interesting things about this recent period is that while people seem to believe in polls that the country's far more divided politically than it was a generation ago, when you actually look at American attitudes about the role of business, about race, about gender, and most of the issues, the important issues, you find that Americans actually are more of a single mind than they have been at any time in the last 50 years. And this comes from surveys not just by liberals, but by conservatives as well.
But that runs in total contradiction to what politicians are want us to believe, that America is so divided.
And politicians have their own interest in, and so do the media certainly, in making it seem as if America is far more polarized than it has been. But when you actually look at the attitudes people have, a former Stanford colleague of mine when I was at Stanford, who's also at the Hoover Institution, named Morris Fiorina, wrote a book called Culture War, The Myth of the Divided America, and he makes this point. He's a political scientist on the right. Alan Wolf, a sociologist at Brandeis, that's on the liberal side, makes the same point in a book called, I think, America United After All. I can't remember the exact title. So people are in agreement that this just isn't true. Americans actually have pretty much the same views on most of these issues, and the views are slightly to the left of center, not far over on the liberal side, but that's where you draw the center line in American politics, and people don't seem to realize that.
Huh. You write in the book, you talk about MSNBC's Keith Olbermann and the Comedy Channel's Jon Stewart as examples of a new populist voice, wry and sardonic, versus a voice that might ape the belligerence of the most prominent right-wing media stars, or for that matter, and I love this line, you write, the insistently aggrieved indignation a lot of the left-wing hosts on the Pacifica stations.
Yeah, I don't know if you've got one of those. You've got one in D.C., I think we've got one in Berkeley, and, you know, I love them dearly, but boy, these people are just the high, keening indignation about the right. And, and the tendency to demonize the right, forgive me, which can be in its way just as damaging as the right's tendency to demonize the left.
Absolutely.
I think those are both bad ideas.
Yes.
And I think that what the left has to find is a more reasonable, not more less confrontational, but more reasonable, as I say, sardonic voice. I think Olbermann's a very good example because he's somebody who's extremely confrontational. He's also very funny. In a way that some of these Pacifica types aren't.
Well, you answered my next question, which was what works about that new voice? What doesn't work? And in the end, you know, if the Democratic Party is still doing business as usual, then who cares what Olbermann or Stewart are doing that might be effective?
Well, I think it's part of the blogs have a place in this too, and Air America is all over the place, but certainly some of the Air America hosts have this, and some AM hosts just around the country. I think what the left needs is a coherent, or the liberals need, is a more coherent story about themselves. A very revealing poll that was done last fall, and actually I just saw the new results. It's even more dramatic. About 70% of people think that the Republicans know what they stand for. If Americans believe that. Only about 25% believe that Democrats know what they stand for. Well, that's a dramatic and disastrous divide. And if people can't, if those parties can't convince Americans that they stand for something more than just a litany, as Carville says, a series of bullet items, then the party's in trouble, however well they manage to do in this upcoming election, owing to just dissatisfaction, in some ways, disgust with the Republicans.
Our guest today is Jeff Neuberg, a linguist at the University of California at Berkeley. Let me ask you, because you've studied George Bush before, what is it you think that most people don't get or don't understand about George Bush, or perhaps something that we should be thinking about the most when it comes to our president?
Well, I think Bush is, people underrate Bush and have consistently underrated Bush. He's an effective storyteller. He manages to convey a sense that he believes what he's saying, that he's a simple man, that he's not, he doesn't trouble himself excessively over complexities, or, as he says, we don't do nuance in Texas. And that's been very effective for him. In his way, he's as effective a communicator as Reagan is, though nowhere near as articulate or capable of rousing emotions in the way that Reagan has. So I think that's one point that people often fail to appreciate about Bush.
And I'm wondering if you have a reaction at all to Donald Rumsfeld's recent request for $20 million to create a new Pentagon program to, quote-unquote, monitor the U.S. media coverage of Iraq.
Well, that's creepy. And you wonder if Rumsfeld doesn't know it's creepy. He just can't resist going there sometimes. You have the feeling that he really is a loose cannon. I mean, it's hard to believe that anybody else in the administration would go there. But I think the way the Republicans have been trying to pull out this new old rhetoric of patriotism, accusing liberals who oppose their policies of being defeatists, appeasers, which is a crazy thing to say, hoping to make a separate peace with a terrorist, this kind of stuff. It's a very dangerous strategy, I think, for the administration. Because at a certain point, it just becomes so ridiculous in the face of what people are actually saying that there's a risk that it'll be overdone. But on the other hand, that kind of talk has worked before, so maybe it will work.
We talked to John Dean on this program a few weeks ago about his new book, and he claims that America is being led by a frighteningly dangerous authoritarian administration that verges on fascism. Fascism, of course, defined as the complete merger of state and corporate interests. And I guess, you know, one voter's strong president is another voter's fascist president.
Yeah, I wish people wouldn't use just stay away from the word fascist. It's a mistake, I think, for the left when it used to do it, and now the right has joined it. Until the fall of communism, the right was much more happy describing people as pinkos and commies and so on and so forth. And then at a certain point, they went over into fascism, too. So you get a character like O'Reilly talking about the ACLU as a fascist organization. 25 years ago, it was a commie organization. You know, there was a seamless shift there. But I think people tend to abuse that word. And with all respect to Governor Dean, I don't think that Bush and Rumsfeld and these people are close to what historically fascism meant. The kind of cult of the state, the authoritarianism, the complete suppression of civil liberties and so forth. That doesn't mean that I'm not very troubled by the approach the administration has taken on civil liberties or some of the things they've been saying, but I just wish people on both sides would stay away from that word. It almost never adds anything to the conversation.
Yeah. I think personally that I represent, well, let me put it this way. I don't represent, but I identify with a lot of Americans out there who don't really feel comfortable with either party today. I know that a lot of my own personal core political beliefs are very conservative. I believe in fiscal responsibility. I believe in a very strong military, and I believe in using them. I believe in free market, free enterprise, and you know, the least that government can have to do with that, the better. But because I believe that, you know, I believe abortion is wrong, but I don't think the government should have the right to tell a woman that she can't do that. And for some, you know, that one thing, all of a sudden, to most conservatives, I'm way out to the left.
Yeah, you know, that's very interesting. The what used to be, and has been, as you as a historian know this, that since Roosevelt's first term, a distinction between two philosophies of government and the role that government should play both in private life and the economy and so on and so forth, has been utterly turned. So nowadays, your view on abortion is much more, for most Americans, is much more telling of whether you're a liberal or a conservative than your view, say, on taxes. And with this rise of cultural issues as definitive comes this new kind of cultural politics where these debates between left and right are reframed as debates about what kind of car you're going to drive to work in the morning. And I think, although it's hurt liberals, certainly, and it's hurt Democrats far more than it's hurt Republicans, I think it's bad for the country. I turned on to Fox News, for example, and the problem I have with Fox News isn't so much just the conservative point of view that they have, but that the people who are articulating these conservative point of views are these bozos. They're the Hannitys and the Ann Coulters and so on and so forth. I occasionally see more response about George Will or others of that type on Fox News or Sapphire. I guess I don't see that at all. But it's dominated by these people who have nothing to do with politics or serious political debate.
Yeah, and that is this, and it is scary for America. I mean, history is a great lesson that these great empires that devolved into cultural politics, they didn't have good days ahead. That wasn't good for them.
No. Whether you look at Rome or Byzantium in the late, well, we could go on as with history, but it isn't ever good when politics devolves to this level of invective, and when the political discourse itself becomes this sort of a reality show version of All in the Family, where we're just bickering with each other about personal, with personal invective rather than debating serious issues.
Now, you can't talk politics without talking. So as someone whose job it is to make sense of the language we use to do just that, what's your forecast then? I mean, where do you see us going from here? I know in your book you talk a lot about something that would work for conservatives or liberals to not bullet point, to don't throw jargons at each other, but really tell a story about who you are.
I think if Democrats can do that, that they will be far more successful in coming years than they have been. Now, it'll be hard to be less successful, so that may not be a great prediction. But I think Democrats have to, up to now, have been running simply on the idea of not being Republicans. You know, the slogan they used, Together America Can Do Better, basically said, well, whatever else we are, we're not those bozos. And while, as I said, that may be sufficient in 2006 when the Republicans are really looking like a bunch of bozos, it isn't going to do to pull that party back. So I think if the Democrats can tell a real story about who they are, and moreover, about the difference between the kind of story Bill Clinton told in 1992, I'm tired of seeing Americans who work hard and play by the rules get the shaft. If they can tell that kind of story, they've got a much better future ahead of them.
Jeffrey Nunberg is a linguist at the University of California at Berkeley, a celebrated author. His latest book is Talking Right, and I urge everybody to go out and buy a copy. Thank you, sir, very much for your time. I know you're busy, and we appreciate it.
Thanks. so much for having me.
Absolutely.
And I hope you guys do better in your next game. We at Cal are still reeling from this last game with Tennessee.
We're going to work on it, and good luck to you as well.
Okay, thanks a lot.
This interview will be archived in its entirety at SevillePodcast.com. Let's take a quick break. This is Charlottesville Right Now.
You've been listening to Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot. Charlottesville Right Now is broadcast live Monday through Friday on News Radio 1070 WINA from 4 to 6 p.m. Best-selling author and historian Coy Barefoot is the host and producer. To interact with Coy and his guests, you can call 434-977-1070. Coy can be reached at barefoot@wina.com. This audio download has been made possible by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network. Visit SevillePodcast.com for more.